Nuclear hope. Most days it's a hard thing to come by. But then a full week of meetings are held at the United Nations on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, and that completely shifts the narrative. What? You didn't know there was such a thing? An international law against nuclear weapons? There is, and there has been since 2017. It entered into force of law on January of 2021, and half the countries in the world have already signed and ratified it or are in the ratification process. That means that half the world is on record as being for the abolition of nuclear weapons. The official United Nations meetings ran from March 3rd through 7th, and on Sunday, March 2nd, a full day of planning and orientation for the campaigners who came from all over the world got us to meet and greet each other and share the vision of a world without nukes. Altogether, almost 1,000 representatives from civil society attended, each one capable of offering many insightful, if not profound, observations on the nature of nuclear weapons, why we need to rid ourselves of them, and what we're all doing in our individual spheres to bring that about. The power and importance of this gathering cannot be overstated. So among the many wise and insightful thoughts and observations shared over 6 days of meetings, when one veteran activist who lives in Hiroshima boiled it down to the essence, tells us,
"The deep meaning of the atomic bomb is that we can no longer resolve conflict through contests of destructive power. We live in a civilization of power, and if we don't graduate to a civilization of love, we will kill ourselves."
And we'll hear more from Steve Leeper a little later on. So when you hear statements like that from every person you talk with, you know you're in the right place, with the right people, all of you doing the right work to rid the world of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We are a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a full-length special report on the recent United Nations third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which ran on a parallel track to representatives from 163 civil society organizations presenting their specific issues, interests, and concerns in side panels. Hibakusha, survivors of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the youngest of them, now 79, exposed while in utero, addressed us in multiple sessions, where we learned that there were also Korean survivors of the atomic bombing. We heard from and honored the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Nihon Hidankyo, a grassroots Japanese organization of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, representatives of international organizations that attended as observers, supported the sessions, and watched what was going on, eager to take word back to their home countries and perhaps move them towards ratification. And for one brief week, the world came together to share notes, brainstorm strategies, build coalitions, and set a course of progress towards getting rid of nuclear weapons. I was privileged to be able to attend as an officially acknowledged member of the media with full press credentials, a rare accomplishment for a podcaster. Today's report will focus on the campaigners, activists from around the world, and you'll hear from individuals ranging in age from their teens to their 80s. They are all the voices of nuclear hope. Today is Tuesday, March 18, 2025, and here is this week's special report, Nuclear Hope, the United Nations Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Truly nuclear news from a different perspective. First, a little history. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, referred to as the TPNW, is the first legally binding international agreement to comprehensively prohibit nuclear weapons, with the ultimate goal being their total elimination. It was adopted on July 7, 2017, opened for signatures on September 20, 2017, and having gathered enough signatures, entered into force of law on January 22, 2021. Promoted and spearheaded by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, known as ICAN, the TPNW is the world's leading tool to rid us of nuclear weapons once and for all. Its passage and implementation is an ongoing struggle being played out around the globe. The meeting of states' parties has taken place twice before, in January 2022 for 3 days in Vienna, with a second meeting of states' parties held at the United Nations in November to December 2024. I attended this second set of meetings and will link to the nuclear hot seat reports that resulted if you wish to revisit them. The week kicked off on Sunday, March 2nd, with the Campaigners Forum, held in the historic Riverside Church. I don't know that I can adequately express the heartening sense of possibility I felt as I entered in an auditorium with more than 350 campaigners from around the world, the majority of them under 35 years old, and some of them still teenagers in high school. These are the best, the brightest, the ones who will carry this battle to abolish nuclear weapons as far into the future as necessary. Each one was motivated, capable, intelligent, insightful, passionate, articulate, and realized that for many, English was not their first language. To give you a sense of what it was like, I walked up at random and asked people who they were, where they had come from, any group affiliation, and what they hoped to get out of this experience. Unfailingly, they radiated a righteous, optimistic energy that, yes, they were going to make the necessary difference and get the job done. Here are just a few.
My name is Paulina Chan. I'm here from Canada. Technically, I'm kind of here with Canadian Voice of Women for Peace, as well as Lex International. I previously worked with ICAN.
And what are you hoping to get out of being here for this period of time?
I hope to get more connected with the community of individuals working on this issue, be able to find new ways to support each other and really push this agenda forward, and gain inspiration from the hard work of everyone here today.
I'm Kati Juva. I'm from Finland, and I'm International Physician for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW1 co-president. Well, I've been fighting against nuclear weapons for 40 years in these different movements, and I think it's the fundamental threat of human existence. And now, when the situation in the world is such that quite unbalanced leaders of countries are threatening with nuclear weapons, and the world is in very unsafe situation, I think it's more and more important to get rid of nuclear weapons, because otherwise we can't solve climate change or biodiversity problems or anything.
And what do you hope to get out of being here for this campaigners meeting today and then the 5 days of meetings?
One of my tasks is to inform back home to the Finnish audience that what's going on. Finland is not part of the TPNW, and we are trying to advocate Finland to sign it, and we are going to meet the UN, Finnish UN ambassador, to tell her also about the threat of nuclear weapons, but mainly of course, one reason is that I've been in the movement so many decades. I've got lots of friends here, so it's always nice to gather, because that helps you to work alone in your country when you have tens and dozens and hundreds of friends in other countries, so you know it's a common movement.
My name is Cooper Christiansi. I'm here from Austin, Texas, and I'm just here as a local organizer working on Back from the Brink, which is a local campaign to get U.S. cities involved in the nuclear disarmament movement.
What are you hoping to get out of the events here this week?
Well, this is just a really great opportunity to connect with so many people around the world involved in a movement that is both global but also needs to be local in so many ways. It needs to start at the grassroots to change people's hearts and minds and to get them really engaged and active in the issue. And so I'm excited to share different ideas, connect with people that are working in very different contexts, but on a shared challenge, global survival, yeah.
My name is Muhadi Sugiono. I'm part of ICANN, so I'm very much involved with all the activities that ICANN is organizing.
Are you one of the presenters here this week?
Yeah.
What will you be presenting on?
I'm presenting on the universalization. Because Indonesia is new state party. For the first time, Indonesia attend the meeting of the state party this year.
What do you hope will be the result of today's gathering and then the week of meetings?
So today's gathering, I hope to give a momentum because this year is 80 years of the atomic bombing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we need to make use of this opportunity to spread the message and strengthen our demands for a world without nuclear weapons. And for the MSP itself, I hope actually that the state party is getting more and more convinced about the case of TPAW and encourage others to follow suit.
My name is Walusungu Mtonga. I'm from Lusaka, Zambia. I'm part of IPPNW's delegation.
What are the issues that are most important to you?
Universalization of the TPNW is very important to me because I believe nuclear weapons are the gravest threat that we have to the existence of life itself.
And what are you hoping to get out of these meetings?
On a personal level, I'm from Zambia, which has signed the TPNW but is yet to ratify it. So I'm looking forward to learning on means and ways in which we can advance the ratification of the TPNW in my country, Zambia. Yes, I'm hoping my country officials will be present. They will confirm tomorrow whether they'll be present or not, but it is my hope that they are, so that I can engage them and encourage them to ratify the TPNW. So that's my main target and goal as to why I'm here this time around.
I'm Jan Weinberg. I'm based in Princeton, New Jersey. I have my own non-for-profit, Show Up America, which teaches people how and organizations how to interact with government officials on municipal levels, county, and the federal government, House of Representatives, and the Senate.
What brings you to this gathering of campaigners and the 5 days of meetings at the United Nations?
Well, I happen to be a full-time peace activist. I have recently joined up with Peak Institute that are here today. Susie brought our group in.
Susie Snyder?
Yes. And I happen to have a grounds pass for the UN because I'm now part of a coalition that's forming a committee to advise the Human Rights Council on decolonization issues. And my study is the continuation of militarization and colonization around the world, especially what's perpetrated from the United States.
What do you hope to get out of your time here?
To be able to advise staff members in Congress better about the initiative that are necessary. Turns out that many of the staff members in Congress are young people and raising young families, or the aspiration too. And if we don't succeed, they're not going to be able to raise their families because we will all be dead.
We'll hear from more of these campaigners in a little while. After an initial hour of heady international schmoozing, we welcome to the gathering Setsko Thurlow, a Hibakusha, survivor of the atomic bomb dropped by the U.S. on Hiroshima, and a key figure in the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. With her articulate dignity, she was central in helping that group promote the nuclear weapons ban and it was she who accepted its 2017 Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway. There were other Hibakusha present as well, including a representative of the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize-winning Nihon Hidankyo, the Japan Confederation of A and H Bomb Sufferers Organizations, and a Hibakusha contingent from Korea, representing those on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, many of them as slave workers, who were subject to the blast, burn, and radiation. The day's planned program started with ICANN's executive director, Melissa Park, addressing the assembly.
Now, I met many of you for the first time in person here in New York at the second MSP, at the Campaigners Forum. And here we are now at three MSPs with much to celebrate, especially the Nobel Peace Prize to Nihon Hidankyo. Just a few months back. But we've also got much to do. Some of you may recall me talking at the last Campaigners Forum about having worked in Gaza 23 years ago and having attended a Hiroshima and Nagasaki commemoration ceremony at the Gaza Harbour in early August 2002. There were hundreds of Palestinian children who'd made little paper boats with candles in them. They lit the candles and set them afloat on the water on Gaza Harbour in the early evening. It was extraordinarily beautiful, but also really moving to think that here were children who were themselves being subjected to bombing on a regular basis, remembering children in another time and place who'd been bombed. Well, the sequel to that story is that a month or so after 2MSP, I visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki for the first time. And when I met the Hibakusha, all in their 80s and 90s, I realised that these were some of the same children who had been remembered by the children of Gaza 20 more or so years earlier. And some of these Hibakusha were participating in rallies for the people of Gaza. They understood how we are all connected across space and time, that the issues are linked. It's the same ways of thinking that justify nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence, that justify the committing of and facilitating of genocide, involving some of the same companies and the same countries. It's the same disregard for international law when it is not convenient. It's the same ways of thinking that consider indigenous and colonized peoples and military veterans as expendable in their quest to make bigger bombs to destroy more lives. This is really what we're up against. It's these ways of thinking, those belief systems that are based on violence, propped up by vested interests. 80 years after the world's first nuclear weapons detonation at Los Alamos, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the creation of the United Nations, the world seems chaotic and perilous. And in these troubled times, it can seem as if things are dark and hopeless. But it is often during times of great chaos and peril that there is also great opportunity. And the fact that we have come together from all over the world to gather in the very place where Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the fierce urgency of now shows us that brute force is not the same thing as strength. Our movement is powerful. It is fueled by love for humanity with all its flaws, for our precious environment, for our beautiful planet. It is fueled by the hope and the expectation that we can and we are making a difference. We have a treaty banning nuclear weapons that many said we would never have. Yes, let's go back. Now, half the countries of the world have joined this treaty. know that many other more countries support it. We're just one signatory away from a global majority of nations. That is an incredible achievement. This week, we'll see how the treaty is working, how multilateralism and support for the rule of law and for scientific evidence is being upheld, how the voices of affected communities are being centred, and how justice for those communities is being delivered. How the security concerns of non-nuclear weapon states are being considered, and how nuclear weapons intersect with so many other issues like health, the environment, human rights, children's rights, food security, and so on. We will see how dynamic this treaty is compared to others in this space, and we will see how what we are doing is working and how what we are doing matters. Now, we are celebrating the Nihon Hidankyo's Nobel Peace Prize today, but I want to leave you with a couple of inspiring quotes from other Nobel laureates. The first is the second Secretary General of the UN, Swedish diplomat Dag Hammarskjöld, who was killed in suspicious circumstances when visiting the Congo in September 1961. And many people believe, and there is evidence to support this, that he was assassinated by Western countries for his work on decolonisation and for generally standing up to the great powers. He is the only person ever to have received the Nobel Peace Prize posthumously. Just before he left for the Congo, Dag Hammarskjöld gave what would be his last speech to UN staff. And in it, he talked about the importance of recognising the value in what you do. He said, "It is false pride to register and to boast to the world about the importance of one's work. But it is false humility, and finally just as destructive, not to recognise and recognise with gratitude that one's work has a sense. Let us avoid the second fallacy as carefully as the first, and let us work in the conviction that our work has a meaning beyond the narrow individual and has meant something for humankind."
ICANN Executive Director Melissa Park. There followed a presentation on The Human Story of Nuclear Weapons by Dr. Lee Tae-jae, who is second-generation Korean Hibakusha, and Hinamora Morgant-Cross, member of the Assembly of French Polynesia, who was last year's winner of the Nuclear Free Future Award. I caught up with Hinamora later that day for this brief summary of her talk.
You spoke this morning. Yes. Briefly, let us know what it was you talked about.
I wanted to highlight the part of the testimony from the affected communities, Hibakusha from Japan, how they started the movement of the abolition of nuclear weapons. And I really think that today we have to be a key in the struggle for the abolition of nuclear weapons, because we are facing the legacy of the nuclear weapons in our life today. And still today, even though the nuclear bomb happens in Hiroshima for 80 years before, they're still dealing with that. And it's the same for all the affected communities, that the territory has been used for nuclear experimentation. So we have to be the key of this struggle.
And what will it be like going to be in the audience of the Nuclear Free Future Awards this year?
I will be very emotional also to see the new faces that will have this amazing prize, and it was such an honor to have that. It's and really a big motivation for me to be awarded with that, and it's giving me hope to continue my struggle, because it's a long way. And sometimes I'm 36 years old, but I feel like I'm 60, because it's something that really passionate me. I devoted my life for that, for my children also, to build a better and safer future for them.
Beautiful as you are.
Hinamora Morgant-Cross from French Polynesia. To hear her full story, we have a featured interview with her from episode number 678, which was presented on June 18, 2024. It's linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 7, 16. Next came a panel on dealing with nuclear weapons from deterrence to apathy. The sound quality was difficult because it came through speakers that were placed on stage, not a direct link. But I managed to capture these remarks from South African Ambassador Martinus van Schalkwyk.
And the message I want you to take away today is the important role that you play. Because part of what I'm going to say relates directly to you, the pressures that you put on your governments, how you get your governments to change the views and to get past the disinformation, the fallacies of the worth of nuclear weapons. But so I'm really, really encouraged to see this. We need you. We need your involvement. And never give up. Keep us accountable, those of us that work in government. That's your role. That's important. And we're moving into difficult times where nuclear weapons are being proposed or being suggested as being necessary because of difficult security situations in the world, which is absolute nonsense. It just makes the world more insecure. And when dealing with countries, so South Africa, together with Malaysia, after MSP1 and after MSP2 with Uruguay, have been working on the universalization and working actively with ICANN and other partners to get more countries to sign up, to sign and to ratify and join up, if not able to ratify, but then just to sign. So, and the arguments that you always get is sometimes from my continent, from Africa, where I am from, is that this is far away. This doesn't affect us. Why do we need to? We need to worry about other things. We've got socioeconomic problems to deal with. This is too big. Let's leave it to the big nations. And the point we always make is no one will be unaffected if there is a nuclear detonation. And a nuclear detonation doesn't mean there will be war. There can be an accident. There can be an incident, there can be terrorism around it. But once it happens, you can't mitigate for it. We will all be affected, whether we live close by and whether we are or whether we're far off. But socioeconomically, we'll be harmed, environmentally, health-wise. You can imagine, you saw what COVID did to developing countries. Can you imagine a situation where there's a detonation, trade is impacted, supply chains are impacted? Developing countries don't have the means. And we saw that during COVID to weather such events. And this is an event we can prevent. So the biggest point always is to point out that no one is unaffected. Everybody will be affected. So we need to deal with that. The other point we can make is that morally where we stand as developing countries and countries that do not have these weapons, we acknowledge the catastrophic consequences of using or a detonation of such a weapon. So the humanitarian imperative has always been one that we hold forth to countries to say we've got the moral voice. We need to let those populations in the countries that have these weapons, or more importantly, the countries that fall under the security guarantees, we turn around to say that we don't have these weapons, it's not so bad. They actively work against us when it comes to saying we need to disarm. Then they say, yeah, but you know, we're part of NATO. There are security guarantees we can't get past. And I think this is what Sven runs into as well with his government and when we encourage European governments. So we see Ireland, we see Austria in Europe, countries that stand up, that understand this consequence. Can you imagine a nuclear detonation in Europe, what that would do to that country, what it would do to us, who's got close trade relations, food security. So we always try to highlight that and to indicate the role that the, and I know some hate the term global south, but the global south can play in terms of moving the debate forward and moving us forward to a world free from nuclear weapons. So let me leave it at that, and if there are any questions later, we can also get into that. But thank you very much for the opportunity again, and keep up the good work.
During the Q&A, Ambassador van Schalkwyk brought up an important theme that ran throughout the week's meetings, the concept of nuclear deterrence as a justification for having and continuing to build and increase the arsenals of nuclear weapons.
The more focus you place on the worth of deterrence, the more valuable you are saying these weapons are. So the more the need rises to have them if you don't. So it is a counterintuitive debate that's being held and not interrogated and not dispelled. And I think that's the very important part. The last point I want to make is just the importance that was mentioned about popular pop culture getting the message out there. People are not informed by books, reports, they don't read it. They are informed by movies, television programs, social media. And we really need to do more to get the message out. I grew up in an age, I'm probably the oldest on the stage. I grew up in an era which was still the Cold War, where we saw mass demonstrations in Europe against nuclear weapons. You saw countries like the UK, there was massive movements against this, and in Germany and others. And that is just whittled away. Those generations, include myself in that, are getting older, and we need the newer generations to take up the banner and to run with this, and in a space that is now so much more accessible. Social media is definitely the way to go, and a weapon that we have that we can use.
South African Ambassador Martinus van Schalkwyk. South African Ambassador Martinus van Schalkwyk. We will have more on the concept of deterrence, what's wrong with it, and what has resulted from this focus in a little while on this special report, United Nations Third Meeting of the States Parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. But first, as you can tell so far, it's all your fault. That is, those of you who donated to help send me to New York to be able to attend these meetings at the United Nations. The joy I felt being in community with 350 other campaigners from around the world, all working for a nuclear-free world, cannot be overstated. And my deepest gratitude to listeners of Hot Seat for your donations, because that's what helped send me to attend these meetings at the United Nations. It truly felt like hope on the hoof, a rare experience for those of us who worked to get rid of nuclear weapons. Wherever you are, whatever work you are doing on nuclear issues, know that in a truly international sense, we are not alone. So thank you to those who donated to support this trip and in a way are the sponsors of this program. But it doesn't end here. So I want to thank you for your future and ongoing donations, the ones that make this show possible on a weekly basis. In the coming months, I will be sharing much more from this event because I have more interviews than can possibly fit on a single show. And I also aim to take some digital media trainings and, if possible, hire social media help to make Nuclear Hot Seat and its message more visible in the world. That's why I'm asking you to not slack off now. There's a continuing need for donations of any size to build the ongoing outreach of this show and its message. Anything you donate is tax deductible, and we make it easy for you to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that whatever you can do to help, you're making a difference to the show and to the world. And that is always, I'm deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's special report, United Nations Third Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. As the week proceeded, we heard from many community organizers, international campaigners, and official speakers. While people remained excited and invested in the ongoing sessions, some thought that they didn't go far enough. Here's one.
Petush Gilbert from Acoma, New Mexico, USA.
And your affiliations?
Several organizations that I work with, Indigenous World Association, a United Nations NGO, Affected Communities and Allies Working Group, national organization, locally two organizations, Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment, and I want to emphasize multicultural. And then from my own community, Laguna Acoma Coalition for a Safe Environment.
You are a fixture at many of these events. What will you be speaking on this time?
Mainly trying to educate people all about the nuclear fuel chain, because the TPNW and the NPT entirely focuses on weapons, and that is too limiting. We have to talk about the entire nuclear fuel chain as the dangers for humans and the environment.
And of course, that has impacted very heavily on Diné lands because of the unremediated uranium mines that are on the land that have so contaminated it.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, the TPNW will not recognize that. They refuse to talk about the essential element that goes into the making of the atomic bomb and, of course, nuclear reactors, uranium. So how do we make this interconnection to the nation states, to the politicians, and especially to the nuclear-armed states that want to increase their weaponry, so are spending billions and trillions of dollars on nuclear weapons? And they also think that, well, nuclear technology is beneficial to all of humankind, so that the IAEA is really helping to promote nuclear technology throughout the world, and they're concentrated on the global south.
The IAEA being the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is purportedly the UN's watchdog on nuclear matters, but so often seems to operate as an enabler of nuclear.
Absolutely. They promote the nuclear technology, and they think that it's beneficial to climate change, agriculture, water, anything to do with, I think, the human environment, that IAEA thinks that nuclear technology is beneficial.
So if you could pinpoint one result of your time here and your talking and not only networking with us, but addressing the world, what would that be?
That they've got to go beyond weapons. They've got to increase their focus on the nuclear fuel chain. Because from uranium to the nuclear reactors to the nuclear waste, that you've got to resolve that problem soon and now, rather than maybe 1,000 years into the future, there could be some beneficial use to nuclear energy, nuclear technology. At this moment, there isn't, because you don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. And, you know, the nuclear waste is all the way from uranium ore that's extracted from the ground, which has levels of radiation, to the mill tailings from uranium that has, again, ionizing radiation, to the dangerous fuel rods that are in the nuclear reactors. Those are the ones that now is the dangerous stuff. Where do you store those? It's a global problem. And that's what I think limiting the advance of nuclear technology today. What do you do with the nuclear waste? Because I think the focus on small modular nuclear reactors just really adds to this problem. And until you can figure out what to do with this spent fuel rods, as a result of applying it in small modular nuclear reactors or the nuclear power plants, you've got an intense human problem.
That was Patush Gilbert from Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico. So where are our future activists and campaigners going to come from? Steve Leeper, who gave us our featured comment at the top of the show, explained this brilliant action that helped bring truly young people into the conversation.
The main reason I'm here is to bring 5 college students from Atlanta and have them come up and help 12 high school students from Detroit. So we had this big group of students here. The students from Detroit were all in Model UN and in the UNA Detroit chapter. And they're enthusiastic, right? And what I have found is that this place is amazingly stimulating to young people. If we can get more young people here, we can get more young people doing things.
You're talking about coming to the UN and at least taking a tour, if not something more?
I'm not sure the tour would do it. What does it is them being able to hang around with veterans of the movement, with diplomats, in the big fancy rooms. You know, it just makes them feel like something is happening here and that they are part of it. And they feel part of it, and all of a sudden they start working. Like, for example, we are supposed to be making a documentary here for that we can take home to Atlanta. They are actively, very actively, going around grabbing people and doing interviews and just they're motivated and they're activated and they're just, it's just such a beautiful thing to see. I'm having a good time with that.
That's terrific. And when that film is made, you will send a link to it to me at Nuclear Hot Seat so I can put it on the website and tell people about it.
I will be more than happy to do that. We're mainly using it to recruit students for Nuclear Disarmament, SND chapters on Georgia State and Morehouse. That's the purpose of this documentary. But we want it to be seen by lots of people, especially young people, so they can get the feeling of what goes on here.
I'll do my best to spread it around.
Thank you.
And when that film is available, we will make it available here on Nuclear Hot Seat. Learning about new programs practiced by other groups is one of the most important aspects of the work available for campaigners. One of these is the Nuclear Truth Project, which has come up with a set of protocols for dealing with communities impacted by nuclear harms and the lived experience of individuals in the process to redress this harm. Here to explain more is Dimity Hawkins from Australia and one of her associates.
Dimity Hawkins from the Nuclear Truth Project. I'm here from Melbourne, Australia, or NAM as it's known, which is the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations.
We were just in a panel that you helped to facilitate on the Nuclear Truth Project. What is that?
The Nuclear Truth Project was started back in 2021 when the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force. It's a project working with Indigenous people and affected community members from around the world. And what we're trying to do with my colleague here, Pam Kingfisher, is we're trying to work with people to sort of look at the protocols that we work with when we're talking to affected community members and how we work with those protocols, both within community and outside of community, walking alongside community. We also make calls for nuclear justice through transparency in nuclear archives. And we also spend a lot of time just bringing people together in conversation to find the commonalities in people's situations when the lands and the peoples most impacted by nuclear weapons testing and nuclear weapons use, but also the broader nuclear cycle.
What are some of the countries you've been working with?
We have been working with people throughout the Pacific, throughout Australia, here in the United States, Kazakhstan, Japan, quite a few countries. We're always keen to hear from people. We're always keen to hear from other communities that have been impacted by nuclear weapons in particular, but also broader nuclear harms and violence. So we're always open to hearing from more. And I hope that while we talk about Mohai Nui today, you know, we might be hearing more from people also in Algeria now. You know, maybe we'll be hearing more from other places where this violence has also happened. So it's just a constantly evolving thing.
What are the protocols and how can people get involved with them?
Well, the protocols was something that was very key. It was our very earliest project that we did, and it arose out of hearing from affected community members.
For those working with impacted communities, these protocols are guides for our actions to make certain we give no offense and do no harm to people who have already been harmed so deeply by nuclear activities. In brief, they cover rights, respect, and reciprocity. And to learn more specifically about them, you can go to nucleartruthproject.org/protocols. And yes, we will have a link up on the website. It's important for all of us to not inflict further harm on these people and communities with what we presume is going to be help. Another project worthy of our attention was brought forward by Rachel Clark.
Okay. My name is Rachel Clark. I'm originally from Japan, but I'm a U.S. citizen, and I am a member of Manhattan Project for a Nuclear-Free World. I'm also a lifetime member of Veterans for Peace. I started a peace-speaking tour with veterans. I started in 2016, so we traveled all across Japan and Okinawa nowadays. We have been conveying the messages from U.S. veterans about the reality of war, which is quite different from romanticized version of war by the government of Japan. And as of last year, we started Project 1030. 1030, guess what number is about? That's the number of nuclear tests conducted by our own government in the past. You think about Marshall Islands? Oh, yes, that's included. But the vast majority of numbers are from our own land. So what we do is we've been collecting wood ash samples from your fireplaces or wood stoves, okay? Deadline is end of May. Please send us your wood ash, preferably sifted wood ash, in double-layered Ziploc, sandwich size of Ziploc bags. Okay, send it to me, and I will forward collected in a big package of collected wood ash to Japan's lab. Do you remember Minna no Data Site? It has so many radiation measuring labs across Japan. They get a measure the amount of cesium-137 from the wood ash samples collected from the United States. So we're going to map up which area of the United States is deeply contaminated. This will be visible, alarming map of radiation contamination of the United States. I would like to prove that it is already too late. We cannot increase any more radioactive contamination. Nowadays, you often hear that the big tech giants wants to reopen already closed nuclear reactors. No, no, no. We're not going to let them do that because we are already heavily contaminated.
If someone listening to this wants to contact you and become involved in this project in whatever way is possible for them, where can they go and what do they need to do?
Well, thank you for asking. I already made a Facebook page of this project. Look for Project 1030.
And that's in the numbers, not spelled out.
Yeah, as a number, not spelled out.
Okay.
Yeah. This will a small fee involved because we have to ask the lab to test it. Okay, so one sample, $50 per sample, that will be sent to Japan for those lab to test samples. Then you will have results sent to you individually by email. And at the end of this project, we will have a nice map, including your samples. Thank you.
Rachel Clark and Project 1030. This is akin to the testing for radioactive samples in dust and ash done by the group Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. That is where the fire broke out, and it's a former Rocketdyne site in the foothills, 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles. The results of this test, it proved that smoke and ash released by fire at the radioactively contaminated former Rocketdyne site traveled as far as almost 10 miles from the fire. If you use a wood-burning stove or fireplace, you deserve to know if contaminated material is even closer than that. And of course, we'll have the links up on the website. One of the most important set of talking points, which came up repeatedly through both the official sessions, the private debates by the private meeting of states parties, and among campaigners, was the myth of nuclear deterrence. ICANN created a great document that very briefly lays out what these myths are, because the concept of deterrence is what is put forward most frequently as a justification for having nuclear weapons. Myth number one, nuclear deterrence keeps us safe. It doesn't. Myth number two, nuclear deterrence keeps the peace. It doesn't. Myth number three, nuclear deterrence is purely defensive. It's not. Myth number four, nuclear deterrence is normal. It's not. Myth number five, everyone believes in nuclear deterrence. Not the case. These five pervasive myths help prop up the fundamentally flawed and dangerous theory that keeps us all under the nuclear threat. So ICANN has put together five quick explainers on how to challenge them when they're brought up in discussion. We will have a link to this document on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 716. And we urge you to go there and not just read it, but download it and share it. It's a cornerstone of our argument against nuclear weapons. Even more important, and a landmark for the progress that has been made, the member states of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons meeting at the UN in New York have asserted that true global security lies in eliminating nuclear weapons, not the doctrine of nuclear deterrence. In the strongest condemnation of deterrence ever heard from a multinational forum, the political statement issued at the end of the meeting states, quote, "Nuclear deterrence is posited on the very existence of nuclear risk, which threatens the survival of all." At the end of the 5 days of meetings of states parties, I'm clearly skipping over a lot here, but we just don't have the time in one program. There will be others. But to help get a final word in, I checked in with two trusted ICANN sources for Nuclear Hot Seat. First, Susie Snyder. She is ICANN's program coordinator. As the sessions wound down, I asked her what she thought had been accomplished.
I truly believe the state's parties here at the TPNW understand the true impact of nuclear weapons. They have heard from affected communities from across the globe, and they have taken that information to heart. Right now, countries around the world are suggesting that more nuclear weapons is the answer, but these states, nearly a global majority, say no, and I believe they will issue the strongest condemnation of nuclear threats and nuclear deterrence we have ever seen.
And that will come out of the session this afternoon?
This afternoon, we're expected to adopt a declaration, and that language will be extremely powerful because nuclear deterrence is a security threat to every living thing. This is not the end of the conversation. We are going strong.
Susie Snyder of ICANN. And the windup for this program would not be complete if I didn't check in with Alistair Burnett. He is ICANN's head of media and the monthly contributor to Nuclear Hot Seat with the ICANN update. We spoke just prior to the final session of the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Alistair, we're here on the last day of the 5 days of meetings of the states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Where are we? What has been accomplished? And what are we looking at going to the future?
Well, we're very, very, very pleased with the outcome. There's been a very busy conference. We had 1,000 civil society representatives from 163 organizations. There were 9 international organizations, including the World Food and Agriculture Organization. The High Commissioner for Human Rights had a representative here, so that other UN agencies are beginning to get involved, not just the Office of Disarmament Affairs, which is something we've been advocating for quite a while. So we're very pleased with the engagement there has been. The outcome of the meeting is that 80 years after the first use, the first test of nuclear weapons, with the states gathered here, the states parties to the treaty, have made it absolutely clear, you know, that they're showing the world that there's an alternative to the wrong-headed doctrine of nuclear deterrence, which is just taking us closer and closer to destruction, because all you need is one accident or one misunderstanding, and that's it. Annie Jacobson was here on a panel, and obviously her book shows very clearly, Nuclear War, a Scenario, that in a matter of hours, the use of one weapon can escalate. And that book is based on extensive interviews with military people. It's not something that she just made up. It's based on concrete research and talking to military experts. So the states here are showing there is another way, and that is through this treaty, that is through the elimination of nuclear weapons. The other thing that we are seeing is that these states are showing leadership at a moment when, for example, in Europe and in Northeast Asia, you have countries, governments, talking openly about acquiring their own nuclear weapons. We're talking about the undermining of the non-proliferation treaty. If, say, for example, South Korea were to acquire its own nuclear weapons, if the Scandinavian countries, who are now reported they're openly discussing having a Scandinavian bomb, this is crazy. This would not just make the risk and danger of nuclear war even greater, it would blow a hole in the NPT. And we've seen how much pressure there's been on Iran not to break the NPT, not to leave the NPT. And yet, these countries, these supposedly responsible Western countries, Western-orientated countries, are talking about acquiring their own weapons. This would be very, very dangerous. The states here reject that. They reject the whole dogma, the whole doctrine of nuclear deterrence. And they're saying nuclear deterrence does not provide security. Because one, when it fails, and it's very possible it could, then that's it. That is massive destruction. We're talking about millions of people being killed by blast, by burns, by radiation, and then billions dying in a nuclear winter. That is not security. That is the opposite of security. Security lies in eliminating these weapons. And that is what the countries here have been doing. And the political declaration that we're seeing is a very strong one, the strongest condemnation, the strongest rejection of nuclear deterrence has ever seen in a multilateral forum, in an international treaty forum. So that is something we'll see. We really welcome that. I think the other thing we're seeing is progress on the idea of creating an international trust fund to support the countries where nuclear testing has taken place, to support the people who are still living with the harm, the lingering harm from their exposure to radiation and the contamination of environment. So we're talking about countries like Algeria, Kazakhstan, Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, French Polynesia. These countries where most of the nuclear testing took place, where interestingly and not coincidentally were colonies or places where indigenous people lived. And that's not a coincidence. We hope to see that there will be a decision at the next conference, and the next conference will be a review conference, so it'll be an official sort of big moment where the countries can get together and review what they've achieved so far and what further actions need to be taken. We're also hoping to see in the next year or so a new countries signing and ratifying. Several countries are here as observers, signatories and others, indicating quite clearly that they're quite close to ratification or a decision to sign. Because we know that there are around 140 countries at the UN who support the treaty. So far, we've got 98 either signed it or ratified it. And we hope to see more, and we think we will see more in the coming year joining. And that obviously creates even more pressure on the nuclear-armed states and their pro-nuclear allies in NATO and in Asia to come on board. Because the more countries that join, the more unacceptable these weapons become, the greater the reputational cost is to those countries to stay outside. It's the same approach that was taken with the landmines and cluster munitions treaty. And look at the situation here. The United States never joined the landmines treaty, but Britain and France did. And they have nuclear weapons. We're saying to them, you signed this treaty. You know, military didn't want it. They liked their landmines, but you signed it anyway. What about the nuclear treaty? What about the nuclear ban treaty? So we're hoping to see some really concrete steps forward and a really strong message being sent to the nuclear-armed states and their allies. Enough is enough. 80 years of living under the sword of Damocles is enough.
Alistair Burnett, head of media for ICANN and Nuclear Hot Seat's monthly commentator with the ICANN Report. And we'll have a link up to the final press release recounting all 6 days of meetings at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 716. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 18, 2025. We urge you to subscribe to Nuclear Hot Seat so you never miss a single episode. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, put your first name and email address into the yellow box, or subscribe on your favorite podcast channel, but don't miss the show. Nuclear Hot Seat is seeking to add a youth campaigner report. So if you are under 30 and would like to provide a report on what's happening in your part of the nuclear world, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and I'll send you information out how to join this new monthly feature. Now, listen up. If you, yes you, have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we always need and appreciate your help. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed, so please link to it, send it to your lists, and if you use any audio from the show, just cite the program, the website, names of the guests whose comments you use, and me. And if you let me know, that's a bonus. For now, This is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, 80 years of living under the nuclear sword of Damocles is enough. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all still in the nuclear hot seat.